Welcome to another edition of the Exponential Podcast. I'm Todd Wilson, Director of Exponential. We're thrilled you're taking advantage of this free resource that was recorded at the Exponential Conference. It's part of a library of hundreds of hours of free training. In our mission to equip church planting leaders, we seek to distribute as many free resources as possible. Visit exponential.org to learn more and to check out the programming for the upcoming Exponential Conference.
What we're going to do today is we're going to just do some story. Now, the posh people call it narrative theology. You can call it testimony, you can call it story, you can call it whatever you want. But what we're trying to do today is to give you access to our story and help you understand why it is that as part of the missional leadership that's kind of developing this missional voice around the world. We were just sitting around the table with all of the great and the good of the missional movement last night. Why it is that in the company of our sisters and brothers around that conversation, our concern is that the missional movement may fail. And it comes out of our experience, and it comes out of our failure, and as such comes with a genuine concern as we look at and engage with people who are hearing the Lord call them into incarnational ministry on the fringes, often of the most alienated groups within society. So that's where Sally and I began. And the way that we're going to do it is we're going to tell you four stories, and those four stories will together give you, I hope, a sufficient insight as to why it is that we're concerned and where it is that we come from. And then I thought that we could have some question and answer and some engagement in conversation. Thank you, my darling. Did you spill that? Okay, that's great. So Sally's going to start, and she's going to start off with one story, just describing some of the work that we did. We became Christians around about the same time. Sally was the very first Christian I ever met. I became a Christian reading the Bible by myself, having been given that Bible by an American missionary who was doing religious education in our state high school. I'd never read a book before. I'd been dyslexic as a child. Somehow some rewiring had taken place as I was beginning to think about God. I began to read the Bible. My life was changed. I joined a local church, and I used to go to the morning congregation in a Church of England church, which meant that the average age was 65. And I would speak to the pastors after the service, just loving the sense of God's presence in the place, but realizing that I was the only young person there. And eventually they said to me, "Do you want to come and meet the young people?" And I didn't know that they had any. So they invited me to the youth group on a Saturday night called Koinonia. We would call it Koinonia now, but Koinonia. And the person on the welcome team was she didn't look dissimilar to now, actually. She was wearing a cream and blue long-sleeved T-shirt. It's true, actually. pair of little clogs, Lee jeans, had very, very dark black curly hair. There it is. Not the blonde that you see today. And she said, "What are you doing here?" Blah, blah, blah. So she invited me into the group, and from there we've known each other ever since that time. So we got married, and after seminary and various little adventures in other places as an ordained couple, we went into the poorest community in Britain called Brixton Hill, and we began a work. And Sally will tell you some of that.
I just want to preface the story by saying, when we first went to Brixton Hill, this was not somewhere I wanted to go. It has all the levels of deprivation and poverty. It's a really dirty, smelly, violent place. And I really, really didn't want to take our two, to me, beautiful, absolutely perfect, blonde-haired little girls into this violent and abusive neighborhood. And so I really, really had to hear from God myself that we were called there. And Mike was extremely wise in allowing me that time to actually hear from God myself, so that when all the storms of the adventure that took place there, I had that rock to stand on in full confidence of faith. And so that prefaces this. This was not something that I went into with a romantic view of mission. This was something that I really didn't want to, but felt the call of God on my personal life and our life together. So we'd been there a little while, and on the route to school, our two little girls were going to the local school. I had to go past a set of shops. Now, in shops, it was sort of like a strip mall, but an old-fashioned one. That's the sort of idea. It was run down, and a few of the shops had boarding, like wood against them, so that people couldn't break in. And as I went by, I noticed this particular one. But more importantly, Mike had really spotted this one, and he said to me, "Pray about this particular building. I think we should have it." And I went, "Okay, what for? What the heck for, Mike? It's like, you know, ridiculous." And which is something I say quite a lot. What the heck for? That sounds ridiculous. But anyway, as I went past in the morning, I would pray about the shop. And eventually, we were able to work out a fantastic rental agreement with the shop owner to provide second-hand clothes to the community. As I'd said, I'd realized that there was a massive amount of poverty. And one of the things is obviously, you know, getting cheap clothing. And we had talked about it and prayed about it and decided that providing cheap clothing would be a fantastic way of reaching into the community. What I didn't realize was that I would get to know every type of clothing possible there was in the world. Every color, every shape, every size. And it completely filled my garage. It was wall-to-wall full of black bags of clothing. However, the most amazing thing was we were able to be present in that community. That we also set up a soup and salad bar. People could come in, people who were hungry, people who were homeless, to actually get healthy food, which was a huge thing in that area again, on a daily basis. It was a wonderful shop. And we managed that shop for about 4 years. Massive, massive impact in the community. Alongside that, we brought about health visitors. I don't know what the equivalent is in America. People who visit mothers after they've had children, provide health care and education before the baby and after the baby. Again, really having researched the type of need, there was massive need. The nearest hospital was half an hour in a car, an hour on public transport. And women, before they had children, basically didn't get any health care. It wasn't because of the cost, it was just because of accessibility. So out of this shop, we provided health visitors and nurses to do that. And this was amazing. We met all sorts of incredible and amazing people. It was just incredible. I remember sitting there and hearing the stories of people's lives and being absolutely shocked at how broken these lives were. And as a consequence, we were able to talk to them, talk about our faith, talk about Jesus, and some of them absolutely came to faith, and it had a huge impact on the community. However, do you want me to go into the however, or do you want to do a however at the end? Okay, so that was a great thing. That was a great thing. It was hard work, but it did have some, impact in the community.
And that impact was recognized by the BBC. The BBC did a commentary, a documentary on the Church of England in about 1988. I forget what it was called, but it's part of the investigative journalist program called Panorama, which is a really famous show in England. And Mike Waldridge, who's a really famous journalist in England, came to our church. And what we realized was that he was charting the decline of the Church of England, which at the time was losing 2,000 members a week. So there were 2,000 people a week leaving the Church of England. And that had just come out in the recent census. And what he did is he gave an hour and 50 minutes analysis of the decline, and then he did 10 minutes on our church as to how it could turn around. And we had no idea that that's what he was going to do. So basically, he came to our church as the example par excellence of how the Church of England could turn around if it was going to turn around. And he had me there serving people in the shop. It's a beautiful shop, and the clothes were wonderful. I mean, it was the first time I'd ever heard Nearly New used for secondhand clothing. You see what I mean? It was called the Nearly New shop. And he was there, and he saw all of our ministry, and it was amazing for us. And very soon after that, about a year or so after that, Sally and I were invited to write books on the work that we did in the youth work area and in the general ministry area, and both of those were bestsellers. You know, this was the work where we started, and what we learned when we were there was a strategy that has since been kind of universalized to just about everywhere that I've ever encountered. It's one of those things where, you know, I once heard a singer-songwriter talk about a really famous song that they had, and they said, yeah, it's interesting, the song isn't really associated with me anymore. The song has its own career. Well, this particular insight that we had when we were there in Brixton has had its own career. And the insight that we had was called the Person of Peace strategy. Up until then, there had been, nobody had written anything down about that, nobody had actually identified that, and The way that it worked for us was our multiracial, multicultural team that we were gathering into this community was beginning to have enormous impact amongst the children and young people. But one of the Afro-Caribbean members of our team was accused of abusing one of the teenage boys. And quite honestly, when that first came, I just didn't believe it. I thought, this is impossible. But as soon as the first person came forward, all of the other kids came as well. And it was absolutely, I mean, honestly, I can still feel the agony of it now. And I felt the agony of these kids and the parents and the rage of the parents. And I began to think about what might happen in our church and what might happen to the community. Community just begun to trust us. I mean, what's going to happen? A friend of mine said to me, that whole thing about the community not trusting you, we'd already had some run-ins with the local media. We'd asked a local professional nursery to give us the rooms back that they were using in our church building so that we could do more children's work. And they got so upset with this that they contacted the local paper and television and picketed the church on Mother's Day. And so we were on TV with that. It was the vicar that kicks out kids. And so I thought, wow, we're definitely going to get absolutely eviscerated on this other one. But a friend of mine called me, a pastor in London. He said, I've just been reading the story of the prophet and Jehoshaphat. And he said, the Lord said to me to tell you, this is a battle you will not face. The battle of the media. And we never did. It went to countless trials. I mean, it was impossible that it didn't get into the papers. Countless trials, countless situations, awful, awful, awful situation. Nobody ever found out about it in the media. It was amazing. I have no idea how that happened, other than the fact that the Lord promised it would. But as I was walking around the parish, as I'm walking around the community, I'm dying inside, and I'm complaining to God, and I'm saying to God in the words of Jeremiah, I am your dupe. In the old-fashioned version of the Bible, I'm your dupe, and you have duped me. You just brought me here to change me, and to break me, and to bring me to my place of crucifixion. Couldn't you have done that in the suburbs? We didn't need to do that here. And as I'm walking along, thinking about how this is going to impact the church and our ministry, out loud, I heard the Lord say, what did the early church do? Now, I don't know about you, I don't hear the Lord speaking out loud often, probably three times in my life. I literally stopped in the street, looked to the sky and said, excuse me? People must have thought I was completely bonkers. I mean, I literally just said, "Excuse me?" And there was no other word. The most important and insightful things the Lord has said to me have usually come by way of question, not by way of answer. Because usually what the Lord does is He drives me back to my first engagement with Him, which is the Scriptures. And so I just went back to the Bible. I thought, I know the history of the early church, of course. I've been trained as a theologian, and I know that story of the early Christians and how they were pilloried and persecuted. They were made the kind of the public enemy number one. They were considered to be incestuous because there was love between brothers and sisters. They were cannibalistic because they ate the body and blood of their leaders. They were anti-authoritarian because they had a king other than Caesar. You know, I knew all of that stuff. But what I didn't know was what the early church did in that context to be successful. Because we were already beginning to do the sociological research that has now fully flowered into the work of Rodney Stark in the book Rise of Christianity. And if you've not read it, please read it. It's the best book on all of this stuff. And it will so encourage you in your missional leadership. Rodney Stark, The Rise of Christianity. It's an absolute genius book. His magnum opus, the Triumph of Christianity, is probably not where to start because it's a bit big and a bit kind of turgid at times. But The Rise of Christianity is brilliant. It's very easy to read, and it gives you this overview. But basically, the church was amazingly successful during the years of persecution. How's that possible? Because it certainly wouldn't be the case, would it, for us? Because almost all of our strategies are based upon public space ministry. And if it's based upon public space ministry and that's where you're going to persecute people, then... So I'm walking along and I don't know how we do this. So I go back and I say, okay, Lord, I'm going to read the New Testament again and I'm going to ask you to give me the strategy that you gave the early church that made them successful. I'd got the vision statement, go to all the world. I didn't know what the strategy was that supported the vision statement. Then I got to Matthew 10, and I saw Jesus sending out the 12, looking for the worthy person. And then I got to Mark 6, recording the same material. And then I got to Luke 9, recording the same material, the 12 being sent out. And then I got to Luke 10, and he sends out 72. And it's exactly the same strategy that he uses for the 12. He sends a team. He recognizes the timing. He identifies a target. And he gives them a simple task. He never sends them alone. He always sends them in pairs, as a minimum. Jesus is so committed to teams that when he wants a donkey, he sends two disciples. We're constantly operating with an individualistic model of ministry. We hire individuals to take on ministry. Jesus never did. He sent out a team. He said, recognize the timing. The harvest is plentiful. In other words, now is a moment when the harvest is ripening. But a harvest is a seasonal expression, which means that there have been seasons before this when it's not been harvest, and there'll be seasons after this when it won't be harvest. But it is a harvest now, and if you can open your eyes, as he says in John 4, if you can open your eyes and see the fields ready for harvest, you'll be able to go and get them. As I'm looking at this, I'm thinking, I wonder where the harvest is in our area. And then I began to realize the harvest in our area was children and young people. But it wasn't ripening elsewhere. I often ask leaders now, I say, where's the harvest? And they say, well, you know, it's very difficult. Nobody's coming to our church. I say, yeah, I'm not asking you, where do you want the harvest? I'm not asking that. I'm not asking you where you would like the harvest to be. I'm asking, where is the harvest? Have you opened your eyes? Well, I'm not very good at children's work. All right, then, well, that's fine. You're obviously not useful to Jesus then. I don't care whether you're a children's worker. I just want to know whether you're a disciple. Well, I don't feel particularly committed to that. Well, fine, that's great. That's fine. End of our conversation. God bless you. See you on the left side of the white throne. I'm sure you'll get there. I don't have anything else to say to you. What do you mean? You mean to tell me that you can identify a harvest and you're not interested in bringing it in? Okay, well, I don't know what else to say to you then. The harvest is plentiful. And the interesting thing is this, the seasons are turning in all of the different subgroups and subcultures within your community. And if only we would open our eyes, we would see the harvest. I'm almost certain that I could come to your community and show you where the harvest is. I'm almost certain I could. And I promise you, if I can do it, as thick-skinned and as idiotic as I am, I'm an Englishman, I wear a bow tie. I mean, you must be joking. You must be able to do it. So, there's a team, there's a timing, there's a target, and what's the target? In Matthew 10, it's the worthy person. In Luke 10, with the 72, it's the person of peace, the man of peace. And Jesus says, when you find the man of peace, in Matthew 10, he says, search, look for. There's a clear intention in the teaching of Jesus that he wants his disciples to understand their work is not to the masses. Evangelism is not about a group. Evangelism is about finding the gatekeeper to the group. That's what evangelism is about. Look for the worthy person. When you find the person of peace, here's the key. Stay with them and do not move from oikos to oikos, from house to house. Now we think building. The word is extended family, household, large group, 20 to 70 people, blood and non-blood relationships. In other words, there is a person of peace who will allow you into their household. And as you live in their household, do not be tempted to go and find another household to get another notch on your belt. Stay with them. Mine out the gold that you find there. How do you identify the person of peace? They welcome you. They welcome you. How do you identify the person of peace? They listen to you. How do you identify the person of peace? They serve you. Eat what they place before you. In other words, if it's a Gentile person of peace, then it's still kosher, even though they're a Gentile, whatever it is that they offer you. Can you imagine how scandalous that would have sounded? So this is how you identify the target, the person of peace. Here we go. You need this. They like you. Now, this is really important because you're going to find a person of peace this morning. They like you. They listen to you. And the third one is the key that most people forget. They serve you. They serve you. They like you. They listen to you. They serve you. Then Jesus says there's a task. The task is this. Tell them the kingdom of God is near. Heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse the lepers, cast out demons. Simple discipleship 101. Nothing complicated. So I said, okay, I'm going to have to put this into vernacular because I'm not sure I know how to do all that stuff. So let me just have a little think. So this is the way that we began to... And of course we saw lots and lots of people delivered and lots of people healed and lots of people cleansed. I mean, the mayor's wife in Pawleys Island, one of the reasons that we live in Pawleys Island today is that the mayor's wife was instantaneously healed of what the Bible would have called leprosy. Isn't that weird? She came to a meeting. I kind of had this thing where I thought, I don't even know what that is, God. And I just kind of got this buzz in my head. And at the end of the meeting, I kind of went, has anybody got a kind of a weird thing on their skin? And, you know, I don't know what it even is. And then the mayor's wife came up weeping. She says, I've had that. She says, I have to wear long sleeves all the time because I bleed through my clothing. And I said, oh, I'm so sorry. How long have you had? Well, years and years, and it's getting worse. And I said, well, let's pray. Completely healed. Completely healed. So, that's just, well, there's lots of those stories. So as as we're pressing into this, I'm saying to the Lord, now what does it mean then in contemporary language to the people of London who don't know the Bible? What is it that I need to say to them, and what is it that I need to offer? This is what we said. God likes you. He wants to do good things for you. What would you like him to do? God likes you. They hear God loves you all the time. They're really surprised when you say God likes you. Kind of what? Yeah, he likes you. He likes the things about you. They hear God loves you all the time and they're kind of, yeah, whatever. God likes you. He wants to do good things for you. What are they? And they'd say, well, I'd like God to do this. And we'd say, all right then. And whatever it was, we'd pray for it. And then whatever it was we were praying for, invariably they would come back and say, you'll never guess. Let me guess. Because God does like them. And he really does want to do good things for them. And he really wants them to engage with the gospel. And he really wants them to be one as prodigal children back into his family. Of course he does. Doesn't he? Well, I'm supposed to be finishing in like 2 minutes. So I'll do the one story about Cockle. Yeah? So, yes, that's right. But I just wanted to give the theological background. Yeah. So anyway, so I'm in the back garden. So I'm teaching this stuff, getting this stuff, looking at this stuff. You know, in a year's time, we'd write it down. And then it gets shared with people like Alf Patterson, and Alf Patterson share it with people like Neil Cole. You know, it's like the whole world's got it now. I mean, anyway, so we're there and we're kind of going through this, and I'm mowing the lawn, the vicarage garden lawn. Mowing, and what I'm doing as I'm mowing is I'm removing the glass out of the grass, because the kids, our kids, want to, because people just throw bottles into our yard, and there's just, I mean, literally hundreds of them. When we first got there, and we had to clear it all up. So, mowing the lawn. And there's this kid comes past the gate, the fence every day, and he's going, "Oi! Oi!" I don't know where you come across, kind of inner city Cockney wide boy. We call them wide boys, you know. "Oi, Vicar! Oi! Oi!" And I'm ignoring him, thinking, because I've got this demonized mower that if you take your hand off the accelerator thing, it will stop and you'll never start it again because it's horrible. You know, it's one of those really ancient ones. And I went over there. I just said, "Yeah, what's the matter?" He said, "Oh, just saying hello. It's all right." "Right, thanks. Do you want to say anything else?" "No." "Right." So then I go back and I can't start the mower. And he does it every time I'm outside with the mower. And of course, I'm out there a lot in the afternoons trying to get the grass all cleared up because the glass and the grass. So he's going, "Hey, Vicar, way!" So I come in one day and I said to Sally, "What's the rule about killing people? What's the rule? Is there a rule?" I think there is. I just, in the back of my mind, I've got an idea that there's a rule. And so I told her the thing. She said, "Well, you know all that Bible teaching you've been doing on Sundays?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "Do you think he might be a person of peace?" "No." "Oh, no." So I go out in the yard as often as I possibly can, and he doesn't come back. And I'm praying and mowing and hoping and don't care whether the mower goes off. I just hope. It took a week. And then when he comes back, he's hobbling on the other side of the fence. So I stopped the thing. He's going, "Hey, Vicar." So I went over, went to see him. I said, "What's happened?" He's got a cast on his leg. I said, "What happened?" He said, "Oh, I got hit by a lorry." A lorry in a truck, 18-wheeler. I said, "Really?" I said, "How are you?" He said, "Yeah, it hurt a bit." I'm thinking, he might not make it. I better help this kid. You know, he might be facing his maker very, very soon. So we started talking. I said, "What's your name?" He's an Irish kid called Cahal. I don't know whether is there any Irish community, but Cahal is a well-known Irish name if you're Irish and Gaelic speaking. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. And he said, we started talking about stuff. And he said, "Yeah, I'm going to be a musician. He said, I'm a prodigy. Oh. I said, what musical instrument are you going to play? He said, I'm thinking guitar. I don't have one yet, but I'm thinking that's what I'll do. I'll just be a professional guitarist, I think. And you talk to this kid, you're thinking, what? I said, so you're 15, you've never played a guitar in your life, and you're going to play that professionally? He said, yeah. Now, what I didn't know was, he's a musical prodigy, and in a couple of years he was going to go to the Royal College of Music. And that weekend, he was going to buy his first guitar. So he said to me, I'm buying a guitar at the weekend. You've got one of those music groups at your church. I've heard you play in the mornings. They want to serve you. I said, yeah. I said, we're not going to plug you in. You know that, don't you? He said, yeah, that's fine. He says, I'll be good enough, though, a couple of weeks. I mean, and literally, today, he's a professional guitarist, and within 2 weeks, he was our lead guitarist. I mean, he's like, you know, like a real, like Mozart type. And he turned up on the first Sunday, became a Christian in the service the first Sunday. The next Sunday, brought his brother. He became a Christian the next Sunday. The next Sunday, brought his sister. She became a Christian the next Sunday. And then the week after that, I was just closing out my teaching on the Person of Peace strategy. And what I said was, okay, what we're going to do this week is we're going to go and talk to our Person of Peace during the service. Because you can see it's a little tight community. Everybody walks everywhere. So they all looked at me and said, oh, yeah. Now, what they didn't know was during the preparation time, I was talking to the Lord about this. And the Lord says, yeah, so who are you going to go and talk to? I said, well, you know, obviously, Lord, I'm the pastor. I'm responsible. I've got to be there for the shepherding of the people. And, you know, like, and then there's like silence in heaven. You ever had those conversations with the Lord where he goes quiet? So I said, okay, who do I go to? And immediately I saw Cochle's mother and father. This is how they greeted me when I first met them. Hello, I'm an atheist, a Marxist, and a member of the IRA. And I went. And then his mother said, hello, I'm an atheist, a Marxist, a feminist, and a member of the IRA. And I thought, oh my goodness, what are we ever going to do with this? These were the people that I had in my mind that I was supposed to go to during the evening service. So we all go out and we do our thing. And we're supposed to come back in 20 minutes, you know, because I'm just giving them this little kind of skill test. You know, go out, have a go, see what it's like, see if they really are the Person of Peace. So I went to their door and I knocked like this. Hear that? I walked away. Said, thank you, Lord. You've obviously just been testing my faithfulness. And I'm glad that I've been found faithful. That I truly am an obedient disciple of my Lord. And as I'm walking away, the door flies open. And Cochle's dad looks around the corner and says, what do you want? And I had no idea what to say. I've got my little clerical collar on. I had to have an operation to get rid of it, but I've got rid of it. I turned around and went, God sent me. And he said, good. I've been wanting to talk to you about him for a while. I went in, 30 minutes, he was kneeling on his lounge carpet, coming to Christ, weeping, confessing. His wife is sitting on the couch as furious as any person could be furious. But within a week, she came to Christ as well. Cochle, today, is the administrator of that church. His sister is a missionary in China. And I forget what his brother does. It's an amazing story. But that's not where the story ends for that church. Sal, come and tell us another one.
In about 20 minutes, so I'll be quick. The story that I want to tell you is a story that some of you have heard already, but I think it's worth repeating. It's the story of Michelle, who became our adopted daughter. I want to describe a little bit our life in Brixton so you get the full picture. We had taken a team of people with us because we knew we couldn't do it on our own. But what that actually meant was a team of people lived with us and worked with us in our house. So in our back living area was the main office. In our hallway was the photocopier. People were constantly through our house. Our house was an open house, and it was absolutely exhausting. I was not a part of the everyday team in that sense of being in the office every day. I was looking after the children and hosting the team that were coming in. However, I did feel that there was more that I could do. The area had huge, huge needs. And in particular, obviously because of my stage of life, my heart was especially tender towards the children. Most of them were in extreme poverty, in abusive and violent situations. And so every day I would see children in this state, and it would break my heart, and I would cry out to the Lord about it. But I knew that I had no real capacity to do anything strategically about that, more than we were already doing. However, I kept on having this feeling that I should do more. And so one extremely rainy and foggy evening, as the dark was settling, I stood at my kitchen window doing the dishes, and my kitchen window was there, and the church back door was halfway between this room. We were very, very close community. It's inner city London, so land is really expensive. And there was a thin, bedraggled teenager stood outside the air vent that was blowing a bit of heat from the church that was being heated. And I looked at her and I felt God say, take her in. This is the one that I want you to take into your household. And I went, are you sure? She's 13 years old. I mean, she's that terrible age. And I looked at her and I opened up my door and I said, do you want to come in? And she came in. And Mike came back from whatever he was doing, who knows what, probably talking to Cockle or something like that. And I said to him privately, I really believe that we should take this girl in. If we don't do that, she will probably become a prostitute. Her mother was a prostitute, her father was a drug addict, and she'd been left out onto the street because she was too argumentative in the environment that she was in, and she was threatened with violence. So basically, she kept on just wandering around the streets. And so we took her in, and she followed me round the house like a two-year-old. You know, like two-year-olds will not move your side, and they follow you even into the bathroom. Well, she did this with me. I would go into the bathroom, and she'd be there, and I'd go, Michelle, and she said, I just need to be close to you. I need to know what you're doing. I don't understand what you're doing. So she'd never seen anybody like clean a bathtub. She'd never seen anybody make up a bed. She'd never gone to a grocery store. So her highlight of the week was going with me to the grocery store, pushing the cart around, filling it, and knowing that we had sufficient money to pay and that then there would be food in our pantry. And this, she said, was the highlight of her week when I talked to her. Her foot size grew by 2 inches. She'd never had a haircut. She'd never gone to the dentist. So there were masses and masses of practical things to do with her, and alongside looking after our two little girls. And however, this would sound sort of vaguely glamorous and amazing. However, she really, really did take us to hell and back. She'd been grown in a manipulative culture, and so she was an expert in manipulating us. She could get anything. And I thought I was tough, but she drove me to the absolute end of a set of emotions that I didn't even know that I had. I mean, it was incredible. I just didn't think I could ever be that angry or frustrated or, you know, completely confounded by a person. However, we loved her. We continued to pray for her. And eventually, through prayer and ministry and through the practical stuff we were doing with her, she came to Christ and she came to a place of healing. And today, she is the proud mother of 6 children. She is a trained midwife. She is married to a wonderful man, and she's just incredible. And she has completely broken the cycle of poverty that her family was in, and has, you know, 6 children, well cared for, well parented, in education. And so that is an amazing victory for that family.
I love these stories because I've forgotten them all. They're great. Really good. So, as you can see, this was great. We wrote 2 books whilst we were there. They're not in print anymore. And they were published in, I think, 89, 90. Maybe 90. I think we finished them in 89, and then the official publishing date was 90. And, you know, it was the kind of the rising church, the star of the urban scene. The Lord called us, because we were just beaten to a pulp by this stage, called us into a period of kind of retreat, R&R. A pastor of some missionaries that were working with us from Little Rock, Arkansas, said, "Why don't you come to our church and help us do mission?" I mean, nobody even heard of that at that stage. "Why don't you just help us do this kind of outward dimension thing?" And so we went and did that with a charismatic Southern Baptist church for a year. How about that? So that's like a non sequitur, isn't it? I know that. But charismatic Southern Baptist church, and then at the end of that, the evangelical dean of the Episcopal Cathedral, so there's another non sequitur, the evangelical dean of the Episcopal Cathedral in Little Rock invited me to preach on Sundays for a year. And so this is like a weird life. I mean, that was like a weird interlude, and then we were called back to Sheffield, and all the stuff that you've heard about Sheffield happened in the next decade. But here's the thing. We saw all this remarkable stuff happen in London. We got to the end of the London experience and we were utterly, utterly spent. Utterly spent. We'd done the best that we possibly could. And we've been back recently. And there's nothing there. It's all gone. It's all gone. And the reason it's all gone is because the best that we could do was make disciples. But we never once made a disciple who could make a disciple. We never did. We never built a discipling culture. And so it just lasted for that generation. It's gone. It's way, way too hard to exist in the storms and the difficulties of that community without people who knew how to make disciples. We did the best we could. I mean, we did the very, very best we could. And we poured our life into it. We poured the best years of our young life into this thing. And sure, there's lots that's come out of it. The Lord, nothing returns void, obviously, if the Lord speaks. There's fruit that continues. But that work has all but gone. And that's my concern for anyone, and particularly the missional movement. If we don't learn that mission and discipleship are coterminous in the heart and mind of Jesus, to do the mission of God means making disciples who make disciples. That is the mission of Jesus. That is the Great Commission. It is what Jesus came to do. Jesus, the incarnate Son of God, begins his ministry and he makes disciples. That's what he does. If we don't realize that, all of our glorious, courageous adventures in faith will be glorious adventures, and they'll be remembered in heaven, and there'll be a star on your crown. but they will not lead to continuous change. They just won't. Take us as examples. And so when we came back to Sheffield from that period of R&R back in Arkansas, and we found shoes again and started to wear them and stuff, and it's just for the people who are Arkansas here, and we started to do the whole work in Sheffield for 10 years. Guess what we focused on? And here's the thing. Sheffield was a declining church, struggling. It had had a glorious past, delightful people, had no idea about mission, really, I think they would honestly say. The people that we left behind 10 years later were the people that we discipled through that congregation. And today, tens of thousands of people on every continent of the world are continuing to see that as the epicenter of their walk with the Lord, as their kind of spiritual home. And it started because that young lady next door, Jo, who came in to, you know, make me look the idiot that I am, that young lady and about seven other young ones of her age were in our huddle, and we built from there. Today there are more than 5,000 people in huddles in Sheffield alone, just in Sheffield. And there's thousands and thousands everywhere else. So, that's what I'd like to give you an opportunity to pause and think about. I think we're stopping in 10 minutes. What I'd like you to do for 30 seconds, just sit there. Ask God, what's the kairos? What's the in-breaking moment for you right now? What's the thing that you need to think about? After 30 seconds of quiet, extroverts, quiet. Let the introverts do the thinking. I'd like you to share with one other person, what is it that you're going away with from this morning? And then we'll have a conversation, Q&A. Okay. All right. We've got a few minutes, maybe five. Let's just do two or three Q&A if we can. Anyone got a question or a comment? Yeah, right over here. Let's just have a listen, if we can. This young lady's going to speak. Just tell us your name and give us what your question or your comment is. Let's have a second. We can carry on the conversation personally, but let's just carry on corporately right now. The one particular book that I would recommend for building a discipling culture is called Building a Discipling Culture by Mike Breen. And you can find it at our booth. Is anybody reading it? Has anybody ever read that? Okay, so that helped you, did it? Yeah, that's great. Thank you. That's good. We'll give you the money afterwards. Thanks very much. That's a very just a couple of extra books. Yeah. So this gentleman and this one, if that's all right, yeah. 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 Your name is Dan. What you're always doing is you're always doing content and context in the life of a person, and we always place that the life of a person in the context in which Jesus did discipleship, which was, in sociological terms, the personal space of 6 to 12 people. Yeah? So what we call the huddle, and again, building a discipling culture will help you a lot. And what's happening there is that you're helping people. This is the dyslexic moment where I start writing the word in the middle of it. What you're doing is you're doing information, imitation, and innovation as the discipling process. That's what you're doing. You're giving them the necessary biblical information. You're offering your life as an accessible model so there's something to imitate. And then you're encouraging them to innovate in their own situation. You see what I mean? As they take the content of what it is that you're sharing them and connect it with their context, it becomes their discipleship. Yeah? But the book that will help you the most is The Huddle Leader's Guide But if you read the Huddle Leader's Guide without building a discipling culture, you might be in trouble. But that's a key thing that will give you the answers to your questions. So really the issue is helping people make the decision to be a follower of Christ or what? Yeah. And the funny thing is that what's happening there is that on the invitation, all of these matrices are the same. We just relabel them. They're actually covenant and kingdom matrices. But what's happening, strangely enough for that young man, is that he's living in this world, which is the world of high invitation and low challenge, which is high contextualization generally and low content. And funnily enough, it's exactly the same place that the attractional church lives. It's a very odd thing, but the people that have made a journey away from the attractional church actually live in the same cultural space and live with the same cultural baggage as the thing that they've tried to leave. Because they don't want to challenge. Do you see what I mean? What Jesus does is he makes an invitation, then he challenges. He makes an invitation, then he challenges. So what I was talking about from the main stage yesterday, the horse whispering of learning how to calibrate invitation and challenge is how you disciple. Does that make sense? Okay. Mr. Mennonite at the back there. Just cleanly shaved this morning, put his hat in the cupboard. Join the club of everyone else who's honest. That's it, brother. I mean, knowledge leads to pride. Knowledge puffs up, and pride comes before a fall. I've had so many falls in my life that I'm much, much more ready these days to admit that I don't know a lot. Here's the thing, though. This is the thing. The way that Jesus trains his disciples is that he teaches them how to learn. And he begins with the summary that he offers his disciples at the very beginning. He says, the time is right. The kingdom of God is at hand. Repent and believe the good news. And that becomes the model of the process of engagement and learning. The word mathetes that we translate into disciple means learner. And so Jesus says, look, I'm sending you out as my learners to make learners who can make learners. Now, the reason we don't put that in English is because it sounds weird. But that's exactly what Jesus was saying that we should do. We're not going out to create something that's a finished product. We're going out to start something that is a work in progress. Disciples are always a work in progress. A person like you saying, I don't know enough, you're saying you're a disciple, therefore. I think that there's a fundamental misunderstanding about how to raise children and young people. And I think that the reason for that is that we've misunderstood the need to calibrate invitation and challenge appropriately at every age group. So, children need challenging, but they need a very supportive and invitational environment in which that challenge is being offered. But if you allow yourself either to jettison the invitational culture of the children's work when you get to teenage work, which means that you lose all of them, or you just continue the invitational culture into youth work and you offer them no challenge, you will lose them all when they go to college. Within the first 2 weeks, they will have discovered sex and drugs and rock and roll, and they will not come back. It's no good saying they're going to come back. They're not coming back. So that's why you've got to learn this thing. And you've got to appropriately calibrate it at every age group. Are we good? We love you. What an awesome group. Thank you. Thank you.